I'm sure many of you, like me, were inspired, I think, earlier this year when the head of the Senate called out Senator Elizabeth Warren for reading, I don't even remember what she was reading now, but some powerful, it was a letter from Coretta Scott King, that's right, called her out and he referred to the situation. He said, nevertheless, she persisted. I have a T-shirt that says that. I actually thought about wearing it today. It was a very public presentation by a well-known woman senator. Nevertheless, she persisted. I think many of us felt a bit of a rallying cry from that statement. But that statement also reminded me of all the people who have persisted, who are not visible to us, who are not well-known senators with national platforms. It's kind of how I felt when I saw the movie Hidden Figures. Why didn't I know this story? Why didn't I know about these amazing African-American women, one of which actually helped save one of our space missions by the calculations that she did? Now, we might not have even known about those women at all if it weren't for a black woman who wrote the book and a white woman who optioned it to make the film, produced it, and directed it. Now, of course, the story was Hollywoodized, right? Remember, those of you who saw it, part of what she had to persist with was, in order to use the restroom, she had to walk like a mile to the colored restroom, because at that time, she was working in a white male environment, and to use the restroom, she'd have to go a long ways away. In truth, the colored restroom was a long ways away, but that woman used the white restroom, even when people protested about it. That's the true story, and I actually like the true story a little bit better, but it's not quite as Hollywood. I like the idea that she didn't need Kevin Costner, the lead white male, to save her and free all the women, the colored women who had to use the colored restroom. This woman did it on her own. I want to name these women featured in the movie: Katherine Johnson, Dorothy Vaughan, and Mary Jackson. Powerful women who persisted. To succeed in the environment where they worked, they had to counter oppression, prejudice, and racism to realize their callings and fulfill their brilliance as mathematicians and engineers. And the world is much better off for their persistence. Now, the title, of course, of Hidden Figures is a play on words, right? The math, hidden figures in math, finding the solution that Mary found, and hidden figures in that the world doesn't know about these amazing women. And both Nevertheless, She Persisted and the movie Hidden Figures made me think of the work of the Reverend Dr. Mark Morrison Reed. As Roger told you, he was a lifelong UU, served several churches, and wrote many books about the history of African Americans in our church. He answered the question of why aren't there any African Americans in Unitarian Universalism with stories and experiences and messages of all those African Americans who persisted for more than 200 years to let their voices be heard. Two books from Mark Morrison Reed: Darkening Our Doorways, the one that Roger read the excerpt from, and then his earlier book in the 90s, Black Pioneers in a White Denomination. I recommend to you all those books, including his most recent book about Selma. So, like the hidden figures in the movie, why don't we know about these African Americans who tried and persisted in our denomination? Did you know that in the mid-20th century, about 10% of our Unitarian and Universalist churches had black leaders in their congregations? Did you know that there were at least 20 black Unitarian and Universalist ministers in the 20th century that were ordained before 1970? Let me tell you about a few of them. Egbert Ethelred Brown is on the front of your order of service. I wanted to feature one of these hidden figures in our time today. He was born in Jamaica in the early 20th century. He found Unitarianism spontaneously by reflecting on how he didn't believe in the Trinity, and then was re-inspired through reading William Ellery Channing, one of the founders of Unitarianism in our country. And so called, he sent a letter addressed to any Unitarian minister in New York City, saying, "How can I be a part of this movement?" This is a man in Jamaica sending this letter. And it found its way to some leaders of the Unitarian faith, and as a result, he was admitted to Meadville Lombard, our seminary in Chicago. However, he was told that since there were no Unitarian churches for colored people, that he wasn't guaranteed anything after he completed his studies. So Mr. Brown left his wife and children behind and set sail for New York. But when he got to this country, he had the wrong kind of visa, and he was sent back. And he had to wait a year before he could try again. But try again he did. He sailed the following year, completed his studies at Meadville, was ordained by the ministers at Meadville, and then headed back to Jamaica to start a Unitarian church in Jamaica. Now, one of his challenges there was very inconsistent funding from what was then the American Unitarian Association. Mark Morrison Reed asked, "Why is that the case?" Unitarians were embarking on missionary work and trying to establish churches around the world at that time in the early 20th century. But they weren't willing to provide consistent funding for Reverend Brown. According to Morrison Reed, the racial attitudes that Brown encountered at the American Unitarian Association posed real obstacles. Their view of blacks was so limited that they never seriously believed that Unitarianism could be grasped by them. While Brown struggled to build greater support for his mission in Jamaica, the association's officers were questioning whether such a mission could even succeed. And so Reverend Brown came to the United States, wasn't able to get traction in Jamaica, and started a church in Harlem during the period of the Harlem Renaissance. Kind of fertile ground, wouldn't you think? Artists and poets and musicians, an amazing time in our history. But he could not get stable funding for his planting a church in Harlem. He had the support of other Unitarian ministers of the time, and one wrote that the American Unitarian Association finds money to support Finns, Icelanders, Italians, and other foreign populations, and yet it seems they can find no funds to foster a work among African Americans. Brown had to take a second job in order to feed his family, and the American Unitarian Association revoked his fellowship because he was no longer engaged in full-time ministry. On the Universalist side of our heritage was Joseph Fletcher Jordan, born a slave, became a Baptist minister, and was called to the powerful message of God's salvation for everyone. Quite a contrast from the Baptist message that he was preaching, and he converted to Universalism. He was a successful minister in Suffolk, Virginia, started a church and a school for children, and he had a dream and a vision for a theological school to train African Americans to be Universalist ministers. He went to various Universalist meetings and preached at various churches to try to raise funds. He needed $6,000 to start the theological school, but only raised $1,400. Meanwhile, the Universalist Association funded a Japanese mission for $6,000 per year, eventually totaling $217,000. But they couldn't find $6,000 for Reverend Jordan's theological school. There are many more stories to share. Black ministers who studied at Harvard or Meadville or other seminaries but could not find pulpits because white churches would not take them. So you say, why not start your own churches? Well, we've heard the stories of two ministers who tried to receive sustained funding to start churches among the black communities, and they were turned away. Now, the Reverend Lewis McGee was more successful. He founded a church on the south side of Chicago with some other ministers and worked closely with the Unitarians. He came from the Methodist faith, but got fellowship with the Unitarians and had a much more positive outcome than some of the other folks that I talked about. I think our association at that point was aware of the missed opportunities. This was later on in the 20th century, and provided financial resources to Reverend McGee. He established a successful Unitarian church in Chicago. But when the story is told of the history of this church, the credit is given to a white minister for starting the church, even though he was only peripherally involved in its establishment. Nevertheless, they persisted. What about women? If we look at women, black women who came into Unitarianism and Universalism, we find more hidden figures. There was a publication, both Unitarians and Universalists published biographies of famous women in Unitarian and Universalism. They published these in the 70s when feminism was rising up, and they published 102 biographies, but not a single one of them was about a black woman. They missed including Frances Ellen Harper, a black woman, a member of the Unitarian Church of Philadelphia, who took the stage at the National Women's Rights Convention and was working alongside Susan B. Anthony. They missed the activist Fannie B. Williams, a black woman and member of All Souls Church in Chicago, who stood up and asked churchgoers, "What can religion further do to advance the condition of the American Negro?" It seems like no one really tried to find these women or share their histories. History reveals so many more lost opportunities for blacks to be a part of our denomination. Can you imagine if these brave and persistent souls had been supported, had been welcomed, had been encouraged? What if the black ministers had found pulpits? How do you think we would be different? What if the 20th century was a story of success in establishing Unitarianism and Universalism among African Americans? How would we have been enriched with that alternate history? Here we are in the 21st century, and it is still a challenge for blacks to navigate the white culture of Unitarian Universalism to get their spiritual needs met. We know that many are called to the liberal religion that we offer, and there are many more African Americans coming to our churches and joining our ministry. And I'm proud to say that our denomination is doing considerably more now than we have in the past to encourage African Americans to enter our ministry ranks. But whenever an African American comes into our church community, they are entering white culture. White culture for their spiritual home. And they have to leave some things outside the door when they come in and face many challenges among us. I think music is an excellent example of those challenges. If you'd been an African American in one of our congregations before the 1970s, you would have never sung a spiritual or a piece by an African American composer during a church service. In fact, it wasn't until 1991 that spirituals appeared in the Unitarian Universalist hymnal. But singing those spirituals in this church community is not as simple as it is. And this is where I'm disappointed that I don't have the wonderful video from Duro Farrar, who's the music director at the Portland Church. He tells us that the example that he used in the video was, "I've got peace like a river in my soul," and how he, as the music director for the Portland Church, had to prepare that hymn, It's a beautiful hymn. He's grateful that the choir is singing it and that the congregation appreciates it. But he knows that it was written by slaves who were speaking about had they had to oppress their feelings. There's a river flowing in my soul. I'm sorry, I've got the wrong one. I'm thinking of our hymn. It's the, I've got peace like a river, pain like an arrow, strength like a mountain. This was written by African Americans who had to suppress their feelings, slaves, and even after slavery, who couldn't express themselves fully without fear of repercussions, even fear for their lives. This Portland minister, music director, speaks of the challenges of listening to black music in white churches, the challenge of navigating his awareness of how white culture is benefiting from black music despite acknowledging the difficulties and the pain that has been caused by whites towards African Americans in our country. I encourage you to take time to look at that video. I'm going to post it on our website. You can find it easily on the Portland UU site if you just type in music director in their search engine and it'll come right up. The reason why I wanted to show the video is because I didn't want to put the words of an African-American male into my mouth and share those words with you today because they were incredibly powerful. But there's two things that I want to say that he said, and I hope I do an adequate job of expressing them. He said that to sing a song such as "There's a River Flowing in My Soul" in a white congregation is a form of white privilege because you get to listen to that song and the beauty of it, engage in that song without reflecting on any of the history that brought that song into being. And then he says that the fact that he can't speak up about the history of that song without making people feel uncomfortable is a form of white supremacy. It's a form of suppression of his values in order to keep white people from feeling uncomfortable. I wish that you could hear his words today. I wish that you could hear the words of this proud black man who's sharing his testimony about what it's like to be an African American in Unitarian Universalist context. So I've shared some history with you. I've tried to share with you something about the testimony of this music director from Portland. And I hope that I've said some things today that make you a little uncomfortable. I hope that maybe I've said some things that make you more than a little bit uncomfortable. And normally I end a service with a call to action. But my call to action this morning is for you to just simply sit with the feelings that may have come up for you. Don't push them away, don't justify them, explain them, or avoid them. Take them in and process all that you have heard. Morrison Reed said, "As we build in the present for the future we dream of, the only foundation is one that honestly acknowledges, grieves, and celebrates the past. Otherwise, we will remain captive to beliefs and behaviors that have not served liberal religion well." I believe that we have to reconcile this past, a tiny bit that I've shared with you, with our vision of who we want to be. And as we grieve this past, we must face the future with humility. So sit with what you heard today. Sit with your feelings. We learned a lot about this in our anti-racist program, Beloved Conversation. We've had two groups now go through that program. And in that program, there's a lot of consciousness raising and facing of painful truths. And then we learn to sit with them. We learn to name our feelings and process them. This is the work of consciousness raising. Understanding that the way that you have seen the world is not true for everyone, and that you may have been oblivious to the pain and oppression that is around you. Morrison Reed says, our challenge today is to develop a culturally inclusive vision that is grand and hopeful enough to inspire, and a way of being that is welcoming to all races and cultures. So I encourage you, as I close, to consider the idea of multicultural humility. Multicultural humility, the awareness that white culture, you white culture, or white culture out there in our world, is one way of ordering the world. It's the dominant way of ordering the world, at least in the United States, but not necessarily the best way when it excludes the values and experiences of people who are not white. So I say thank you to those people of color who persisted in staying with Unitarian Universalists throughout our history, and those who persist today. And to all of us, I say, let us bless our journey, wherever we are on our journey of multicultural humility. Let us walk this path together in love. Blessed be.